Okay, so today we'll continue with the book of Jude. We started with the Jude last week, and we know that Jude was written by Jude, who's the half brother of Jesus, and he was saved after the resurrection of Lord Jesus Christ, and he was able to call himself as the servant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, as we read in verse 1. So in the book of Jude, we see that the believers are on the attack. And the attack is not coming from outside, but it is coming from inside through false teachings that we touched upon last week. So, as you have seen in the book of Jude, there are only 25 verses, but we touch upon many things, many different topics, many different characters. So, even though it's only 25 verses, if you really want to spend time, we can spend a lot of time on it, starting with the journey of Israelites, which is covered in the book of Deuteronomy and other places, and many other characters like Adam, Moses, and so on. And for the most part, we recognize Jude for the doxology, which we find in verses 24 and 25. But as we've been seeing last week too, there is much more to learn. So there are two main themes that we see in the book of Jude. One is the warning on false teachers. So we need to be careful about what we are being taught. So there is a warning there. And at the same time, we are challenged to contend for our faith. We are asked to contend for the truth of the gospel. So that is the main focus that we see in this book. So last week we saw some threes or some groupings of threes that is common in the book of Jude. So when he speaks about the identity of believers, he recognizes that believers are the one who are sanctified or they have been separated from the world and they are preserved or they are kept or from salvation till the end of time. And they're also called in the sense, not only just called, but they also responded to the gospel. And then he speaks about three blessings on believers, that mercy, peace, and love would be multiplied. And when we have experienced the mercy of God and peace with God and also his love, we should be able to extend the same mercy and peace and love to others. And we also saw the unbelief of Israelites when they made it all the way to the promised land, but they did not have faith that God can help them conquer the giants. And also we saw the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah and also the fallen angels. And in all three cases, we saw that the end result was destruction. And we were also introduced to the certain men, which was the starting point for the second section, as it says in verse 4, for there are certain men crept in unawares. So these are the men, the false teachers that are causing confusion and corruption in the church. And they are described in many different ways throughout the book, based on their character, based on their actions. And they're also described in some metaphors like wandering stars or raging waves and so on. So we'll take a look at some of these as we go through the next section. So we'll start with verse 11. We stopped at verse 10 last week. So verse 11 says, woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsayings of Kor. So here again, we see the author is looking at a group of three, but the focus is still on the same verse, which is verse 4. There are certain men crept in unawares. So by describing all of these characters and all of these experiences, we are able to draw some lessons about what to look for when we are looking at false teachings. What is their character? What is their fruit? And what is their life? So it speaks about the way of Cain, the greed of Balaam, and the insubordination of Korah. So we'll start with the first one, which is the way of Cain. And of course, we find the story of Cain and Abel right in the book of Genesis. And the way of Cain could be seen as the way of unbelief, the way of jealousy, the way of bitterness, the way of anger, and the way of murder. And in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4, it also reinforces that the way of Cain is the way of unbelief by contrasting it with Abel. So it says in Hebrews 11 and verse 4, by faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained a witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts. So by exercising faith, Abel was declared righteous. And again, in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 12, it says, not as Cain, who was of the that wicked one and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. So the way of Cain also reminds us about the worship of false teachers. They offer worship without faith, they offer worship without understanding, and they offer worship without honoring God's instructions or God's divine pattern for worship. And of course, we see that today in many different churches, in many different denominations, where they might be having a time of worship, but people might be offering worship more as an experience, more as a celebration, a social celebration. And we see that some critical elements are missing. The faith might be missing, the true understanding of God might be missing. And they might be simply doing it using their intellect rather than using God's instructions. In contrast, we would see that the worship of believers, it would be offered in spirit and in truth, as we read in John 4:23. And believers will also offer themselves as a living sacrifice. So it is not an event that takes place external to our life or independent of our life. So we cannot separate the worship that we do with the way we are living. So if we are not able to offer ourselves as a living sacrifice, then we can see that our worship will also not be a true experience. And scripture also reminds us that believers they are able to worship in all seasons because the worship should not depend upon our circumstances. It should not depend upon what we are going through, because when we are coming to worship, we are focusing on God and we are focusing on His attributes. So even though we might be going through a low season in our life, we see that true believers like Habakkuk and Job and so on, they were able to worship God despite the situations that they were going through. And the second character that he talks about is the greed of prophet Balaam that we read about in the book of Revelation and also in the book of Numbers. Yeah, maybe someone can read. We'll just read a few verses just to get the context and then draw some lessons. Yeah, maybe someone can read Numbers 22 verses 1 through 6, then 12 and 18. Sorry.
And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. And Balak the son of Zippor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was sore afraid of the people because they were many, and Moab was distressed because of children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, Now shall this company lick up all that are round about us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And the Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. He sent messengers, therefore, unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of the children of his people, to call him, saying, Behold, there is a people come out of the out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that they may we may smite them, that and that I may drive them out of the land. For I would that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. 12.
12, yes.
And God said unto Balaam, Thou shalt not go with them, thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed.
Yeah. Verse 18 says, And Balaam said, Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold. I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. So here we see two characters. We have King Balak, and we also have Balaam, who's the prophet. And the king wants the prophet to curse. But when he goes to God to seek his permission, God says he cannot curse the people, for they are chosen, or they are the blessed ones. And even though he's getting an offer of riches, and despite the riches, as a prophet, he should be faithful to God. He should be the mouthpiece of God, so he should not curse. So we see the story in Numbers 22 to 25, and also there is a reference in chapter 31. So if you're interested, you can read through the entire chapters. So we see that when the first visit is made by Balak's men to curse Israel, Balaam listens to God and he does not go, as we read. And when there is a second visit, which also takes place, God permits the prophet to go. But as we read further, we can interpret that it is not God's perfect will. God is permitting him to go, but he tells him that even though he may go, he should only speak the words of God. So there is no reason for him to go and obey the king. Even if he goes, he should obey God's voice. But God is able to discern that Balaam's intentions are not good, and he is going to disobey. So we read in verse 22 that God is angry, but Balaam continues to proceed despite being blocked by the angel of God three times. And there comes a point when God makes the donkey to speak and to rebuke Balaam. And he acknowledges his sin, or he acknowledges his mistake. So the king tries multiple times for Balaam to curse, but every time he speaks, only words of blessing are released. As we read in 23:8, how shall I curse whom God hath not cursed, or how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defiled? And again in verse 26, which is a different incident, which again repeats the same, told not I thee, saying, all that the Lord speaketh, that I must do. So there comes a point when even though Balak is trying to make the prophet to curse, but only blessings are coming, so they give up, as we read in verse 25 of chapter 24. And Balaam rose up and went and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. But the story doesn't end here. In Numbers 25, we see the counsel of Balaam, which is also known as the doctrine of Balaam, where since he was not able to curse Israel, the counsel that he gives is that if Israelites can be tempted to fall into sin, God himself will curse them. So in this case, he is not directly engaged, in cursing the people of Israel, because obviously that did not work. So he says if Israelites can fall into sin, then God himself will chastise them and he will curse them. And that is what we see happens. The Israelites are tempted to mix with the Moabite women, which leads to immoral behavior and idolatry. And God's anger is aroused, and it leads to the death of 24,000 people. So in chapter 25, verse 4 of Numbers, it says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel." And those that died in the plague were 24,000. So here, if you go through and read all the chapters, we see the greed of Prophet Balaam, and we see the doctrine or the bad counsel of Balaam. So he is guilty of leading people to sin, and he is guilty of leading people to death because of his love for money or because of his greed for money. So in Revelation 2:14, when we see the writings, messages to different churches, we read in 2:14, "I have few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam," which we associate with the love of money or the greed of money. And 2 Peter 2:15, it says, "The way of Balaam, the son of Bozor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness." So as believers, we should strive for the reward of righteousness. We should not be in the path or the wages of unrighteousness. And the wages of unrighteousness is punishment from God, just like the wages of sin is death. In the same way, the wages of unrighteousness or unrighteous ways or the greed or the love of money will also lead to death, or at least in a spiritual sense. So Numbers 25:7, it says, "And they warred against the Midianites as the Lord commanded Moses, and they slew all the males, and they slew the kings of Midian besides the rest of them that were slain." And one of the names on the list is Balaam, also the son of Beor, they slew with the sword. So that was the end of the prophet. That was not the end that God had designed for him, but because of his greed, because of his love of money, because of the bad counsel that he gave, God took him out. God punished him through a cruel death. So we see that he was guilty of love of money, and we read in the scriptures about Judas himself, who denied Christ for 30 pieces of silver. And even today, we find that many preachers, they are guilty of falling into the temptation of money, or falling into the temptation of worldly ways or worldly lifestyle. And we also know that many preachers, they treat ministry as a profession. And oftentimes, when the ministry is growing, it is not led by the will of God, but oftentimes it is led by financial reasons rather than spiritual reasons. So we see many churches that have grown really big. They might have a big organization, they may have a big setup with a big salary and perks for the preachers or for the leaders in the church. So there we see that money plays a role. And many a time the growth is being driven by wrong motives. And God is going to judge that. And that is the warning that is given to us. And the third incident that we see is taken from Numbers 16, where Jude speaks about the insubordination or the rebellion and covetousness of Korah and his followers. So Korah is a Levite, and along with, if we read number 16, You'll also find the names Dathan and Abiram, and 250 princes or 250 leaders who rise up against Moses, who was the leader at that time, and Aaron, who was the priest. So they despised the authority and the anointing that is given by God to Moses as the leader and Aaron as the priest. So we can see that they coveted the power and the authority that was given to Moses and Aaron. And as the chapter goes, we see that each group brings incense to the Lord and to see which one the Lord will accept. And that is how the judgment will be made in terms of who's right and who's wrong. And we see the great challenge that is given by Moses in Numbers chapter 16, verse 28. It says, "And Moses said, hereby ye shall know that the Lord hath sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of mine own mind." So they were questioning the authority of Moses. They were questioning the decisions that were being made by Moses. And Moses is reminding them that he's not doing it on his own. He's simply doing what the Lord is asking him to do. So in verse 29 and 30, he gives the challenge. He says, "If these men die the common death of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord hath not sent me." So that would be the easy thing to do, where people die a natural death and Moses is declared guilty. But in verse 30, we see that the standard that he sets is very unusual. He says, "If the Lord make a new thing and the earth open her mouth and swallow them up with all that appertain unto them, and they go down quick into the pit, then ye shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord, or they are guilty." So we see that Moses is giving a great challenge that reminds us that Moses has great faith in God, and he has great faith in the authority that God has given him, and he also has faith in God's justice, so that publicly he is able to challenge the 250 plus people who come. So what happens next is we see in Numbers 16:32, just like Moses challenged, which seemed like a impossible thing, but it is the impossible thing that happens that vindicates him and declares them to be guilty. So we read in verse 32, "The earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, and all their goods, they and all that appertained to them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed upon them, and they perished from among the congregation. And there came out a fire from the Lord and consumed the 250 men that offered incense." So this is a very unusual incident that is recorded in the scriptures about how Moses challenges the challengers, so to speak. So there are three lessons that we can draw from this incident: that we should not be jealous, or we should not covet someone else's ministry that is God has given them, or any calling or position that they may have. So, which is in contrast to what we see among false teachers, that they would seek power and they would seek positions. And secondly, we should rejoice in the success of others. We should rejoice in the successful ministries of others, which would again be a contrast. The false teachers, they would feel threatened and they would feel jealous when other ministers are more successful, or maybe other churches are more successful. They would feel threatened. And the third lesson that we can draw is that the Christian race is about completion, and the Christian calling is about completion. It is not about competition, as we read in Hebrews chapter 12. But false teachers, they would seek personal glory while undermining others. So again, Jude is able to draw an incident from history to again remind us of the character of false teachers and what to look for when we are trying to discern the certain men that have crept in unawares. Yeah. So he continues on the same theme in verses 12 and 13. He speaks about certain men in by using some metaphors. He says, these are spots in your feast of charity when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are without water, carried about with winds. Trees whose fruit withereth without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. Wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So here we see different images. Maybe it can be interpreted in different ways. So we'll just see how we can do that. So firstly, he speaks about the spots in feast. So when we think of fellowship meal or communion or love feast in the New Testament, it is generally when everyone brought what they could afford and they shared the meal after worship. And those who could not bring anything, they would simply participate in the meal. So the rich would share with the poor, and that is how the fellowship meal will take place. But here we see that false teachers, they are shepherds that selfishly feed themselves instead of feeding others. So that could be taken in a physical sense. It could be taken in a spiritual sense. We see something similar when we read 1 Corinthians chapter 11. There also we see that people are feeding themselves instead of sharing and enjoying the time of fellowship. So false teachers, they are spots or they are blemishes upon the church testimony, or we can say they are spots among things that the Lord has ordained. They would always try to disrupt the order or the pattern that has been established by the Lord or by the church. But when we think of the bride of Christ, we have to strive for a higher standard. The bride of Christ will be spotless, as we read in Ephesians 5:27, that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. And of course, we cannot reach that point in this lifetime, but still, our goal should be to be moving in the direction of living a life that is without any spot, without any wrinkle. And whatever blemishes we have, we know that the Lord will fix it when he returns. But we should not be heading in the wrong direction and picking up more spots, more dirt, more wrinkles, and more blemishes in our spiritual life. Then he speaks about the clouds without water. He says they are clouds without water carried about of winds. So it can be seen as fleeting clouds, clouds that appear, but then they are dispersed by winds. We see the clouds, but there is no water. We may think that the clouds are forming and there is a hope for the rain, but the rain never comes. So these are just illusions or false hopes, or it is something that is unreliable and something that is unpredictable. So in the same way, false teachers, they may give the illusion of giving rain, or they may give the illusion that they are actually giving a blessing, but at the end, they will disappoint us and they will leave us empty and unfulfilled. So that is why we see that many who are associated with organized religion or organized systems, they may feel that they are going through an experience, but at the end, oftentimes they feel empty, and oftentimes they are not satisfied spiritually, because the person feeding them is not a true teacher, but they are false teachers. They are like clouds without water. And using a similar analogy, he says they are trees without fruit, trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, and plucked up by the roots. So obviously, trees, the main purpose for the trees would be to give fruits. Of course, the trees serve other purposes also, but we generally associate trees with fruits. And here it says they are twice dead, they are fruitless, and at the end, they are uprooted and they are rejected in eternity. But as believers, we are called to be fruitful. As we read in John 15, 16, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain. So not only are we asked to bear fruit, but we are asked to bear fruit that would remain, or that would sustain over time. So it should not be a one-time thing. The work that we are doing should be a fruitful work that continues to bear fruit, that continues to multiply over time. Then he speaks about raging waves of the sea foaming out their own shame in verse 13. So raging waves, if you're standing by the ocean, we can see that they're very noisy, they're very boisterous, but at the end, there might be only destruction and disruption from stormy seas. So just because we are making a lot of noise does not mean that we have a powerful ministry, does not mean that we have a fruitful ministry. It may simply be a noise, it may simply be creating a lot of distraction, but it may not yield any fruit at the end. So Isaiah 57 say 20 says, the wicked are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. So that is how the false teachers are. They are like the raging waves, and they don't really produce anything that is fruitful. It is only at the end, when God does the analysis, it is simply dirt and worthless things. Then we are told they are wandering stars. And obviously, wandering stars, they cannot guide anyone, because they are moving without any pattern, without any direction. So in the same way, the false teachers, they are selfish, they are opportunistic leaders, or leaders without any concrete vision designed to benefit the followers. So they're not in the ministry, or they're not in the work to benefit others. They're doing it for selfish reasons, and they're looking for opportunities so that they can accumulate wealth, or they can accumulate fame or positions and so on. So they are like the wandering stars. They will jump from place to place. Wherever they see an opportunity, they will jump to that space to capture that. But we read in Matthew 2:9 about the guiding star, and lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. So a true teacher would bring people to the Lord, because that is the ultimate destination. We need to bring people to Christ. And but if you're wandering stars, then we don't really have a destination in mind. But if you're a true star, if you're a true witness, then you will guide people in the right way, and you will bring them to the point of salvation, or you'll bring them to the cross and explain the gospel. And the final destination, as we read in verse 13, for all of these people, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So we see that God is just. False teachers, they may enjoy short-term fame, They may enjoy power, they may enjoy riches, they may enjoy a lot of publicity through meetings that they may have on stadium, or it could be on YouTube and so on. But all of that is short-lived because they are false teachers. But at the end, they would face God's eternal justice, and the blackness of darkness is reserved for them. And Jesus also reminds us in the Sermon on the Mount. He says in Matthew 7:22, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you, depart from me, ye that work iniquity. And we'll close with verses 14 and 15, which speaks about Enoch's prophecy. It says, and Enoch, also the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these things, saying, behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints to execute judgment upon all, and to convince all that are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So we see that Enoch is seventh from Adam. So when we count Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalil, Jared, and Enoch. And if you go all the way to Noah, then we have two other generations, Methuselah and Lamech. So we also see that Enoch was lifted up before the flood, or before the judgment. He was spared the wrath of God because he was considered righteous. So that is again a picture for us that the Lord will come and take us to be with him before the great tribulation. So we would be lifted up, which would be the rapturous experience. And after that, the judgment of the great tribulation would come, just like the flood came and destroyed all the unrighteous people. And the prophecy of Enoch that we just read is not found in the Bible. So here Jude is quoting from an apocryphal book, or which is the book of Enoch. So this would be a book which is not part of the scriptures, part of the Old or the New Testament, or it would be the writings that were written between the book of Malachi and the book of Matthew, where there is a 400 year gap. So it is said that Jews abolished and destroyed it because many of the prophecies concerning Christ are found in this book. So these books, they might be rich in traditions, and they may say things about history which may be true, but at the same time, it may not be the complete truth since they are not part of the scriptures. And some believe that Methuselah, who lived the longest in the Bible, 969 years, so he might have recorded what Enoch said, or the prophecy that he had. But we cannot be sure because it is not in the scriptures. But we know for sure that Christ will return for the church, as we read in 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 through 17. And we also know that Christ will return after 7 years tribulation. He will return back with the church to begin the thousand-year rule. But the ungodly, they will face the same consequence as we have been seeing. The theme is consistent, that God is just and he is going to punish the ungodly for their ungodly words and ungodly deeds, which is what the false prophets are. And verse 16 says, these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lust and their mouth, speaking great swelling words, having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. So here he speaks about the certain men in the context of the tongue. So we can find out who are these certain men even by listening to what they are saying. So here he points out the sins of the tongue. So these would be people who are always murmuring or always grumbling. So they're not really content because they do not have the Lord in their life. So we cannot be content or we cannot be complete because it is Lord Jesus Christ who makes us complete. So if we do not have Christ, then we will not be content. And when we are not content, it also leads to bitterness. It also leads to negative thoughts, negative opinions, and so on. And we also see that these people are complainers. They would be complaining about others. They would be complaining about God when they're going through difficult times. And they would also be complaining about the church. And we also see they're also flatterers, or they will try to gain favors by showering empty praises, which are again lies. So those are three things that Jude recognizes among the false teachers. They are murmurers, they are complainers, and they are flatterers. And Proverbs 28:23 says, "He that rebuketh the man afterward shall find more favor than he that flattereth with the tongue." So here, Proverbs is reminding us it is better to rebuke someone than to flatter them with lies. And the same way in Proverbs 20:19, he that goeth about as a talebearer or a gossiper revealeth secrets. Therefore, meddle not with him that flattereth with his lips. So we are given a strong warning throughout the scriptures that we need to control our tongue. And the lies of the tongue, which can be slander, where we spread false things, or when we flatter people, telling them what they really are not, or gossip, would be considered sinful. So, as we are going through this, we see when we are looking at true versus false teachers, the focus is on the character, the focus is also on the content of teaching, and the outcome of the ministry. So we'll come back to this when we wrap up. So just a few quick reflections. Firstly, we see that anytime there is greed, anytime there is pride, or anytime there is selfish ambitions, it will destroy God-given ministry for us or for the church as a whole. And secondly, we see that we must look out for false teachers that have crept in. And oftentimes, when we think of false teachings, we simply focus on the doctrines or we focus on what they are teaching. But Jude reminds us that we need to look at the entire thing. We not only have to discern what they are teaching, but we also need to discern their character, and we also need to discern whether they are bearing fruits or whether they are barren. And all of those would be indications if the doctrine is flawed, or if their character is not good, or if they're not bearing fruits, then it is quite possible that they are false teachers who have crept inside the church.